Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories of the past week. Our lead story today, once again, concerns the coronavirus, but there's a new twist. For months, the government and learned scientific bodies have been telling us, stay at home. And that in turn initiated a lockdown, which collapsed much of the world's economy. And now scientists are beginning to say, oops, maybe we should have qualified that statement. Maybe sometimes the home is the least likely place that you should go to seek haven from the coronavirus. And also, speaking about the virus, the Russians announced recently that they're now giving out a new anti-coronavirus vaccine. And the question is it a hoax? Is it just propaganda? Or is there some real science there behind the Russian announcement that they have a vaccine? And then we're going to talk about global warming. It turns out that, of course, scientists know that Greenland is melting. However, is Greenland passing the point of no return, the point at which the greenhouse effect spirals out of control, even if we were to rein in the greenhouse gases? One group of scientists are saying, yes, we are now passing the point of no return in terms of saving the glaciers of Greenland. And the question is, what does that mean for us? Also leaving the Earth and going into outer space, astronomers have now identified the closest black hole to the planet Earth. That's right, it is a hop, skip, and a jump from the planet Earth, just 1,000 light years. Who would have thought that a raging black hole, roughly 4 times more massive than our sun, could be blazing away so close? And get this, it is almost visible with the naked eye, even without binoculars. So tonight, when you look in the night sky, maybe you can see a black hole with the naked eye. And speaking about the world of astronomy, yet another giant asteroid or comet whizzed by the planet Earth, skimming the surface of the Earth by 1,000 miles. That's a hair's breadth. Realize that the moon is 250,000 miles away. And so this object, about the size of a car, whizzed by the planet Earth at 0.5% the distance from the Earth to the moon. And the question is, what might have happened if that object that we did not even understand its presence were to hit the Earth? Once again, astronomers have been caught flat-footed with their pants down, not realizing that there are these gigantic chunks of rock whizzing right under our noses. Well, let's just jump right into the top stories of the past week. You know, for months now, the government has been telling us, lockdown, stay at home. That's where you should be, at home. In fact, you can still see statements on TV even today saying, yes, you should stay at home. Well, scientists are now beginning to rethink that whole thing. Scientists now have thousands of data points as to where the clusters of the coronavirus originate. And they were shocked to find out where these clusters came from. At first, you might think, well, maybe they came from gigantic football games and huge frat parties with all the guys and girls having a great time without masks. Well, no, that did not turn out to be the number one cluster point. The number one source of coronavirus is your home. That's right, the very place where the government's been saying, stay at home for so many months. And now thinking about it, it's kind of obvious that it would be your home. First of all, think about it for a moment. 15% of all clusters come from your home. And why is your home the source of so much misery, death, and disease? Well, first of all, you're talking about your kids, your friends, your close relatives, one of whom may have the virus, one of whom does not obey masking, does not obey the 6 feet separation guidelines. One person can infect the entire household. Second of all, the household is indoors. Indoors, the virus circulates. You breathe basically reused air, air that could have the virus. And compared to outdoors, you're 20 times more vulnerable than someone outside. Next, what exactly is the mechanism that transports the virus into your body, perhaps causing you to die? Well, it's not eating utensils. It's not washcloths. No, it's none of the things that people originally thought. It's conversation. That's right. The intimate chatter that goes on at the dinner table, that's where the virus spreads, at home. Not at these gigantic parties that you see on TV all the time. Yes, they are dangerous. Yes, they shouldn't be partying like that. But that's not where most of the coronavirus clusters come from. It's close contact. It's breathing. It's coughing, sneezing, of course. But just in the presence of yelling, laughing, that could also trigger a cluster of the coronavirus. And of course, you're stuck in the house for hours at a time, breathing the same air. And so in other words, of course, for the most part, if you know that everyone is safe, then yeah, stay at home. That's where you should be. I was tested. I came out negative. You should get tested too. Because if there is someone in your household that's positive, they could be spreading the virus immediately to everyone, because that's where most of the clusters come from. They don't come from frat parties and sorority parties. They, of course, do contribute, but mostly it's people infected like mom and dad, grandpa and grandma, because their teenage kids run off and take off their masks and party too much. And so we're beginning to realize that some of the common sense attitudes and precautions that we took are actually wrong. Now, of course, the CDC is very conservative, takes time for new guidelines to come through. And these guidelines, of course, are for millions of people, so they have to be very precise and very cautious. But there is a new consensus developing among epidemiologists, the fact that airborne viruses, viruses on particles of droplets of water that are microscopic, could be one of the main ways in which the virus is transmitted in your home. And once again, the CDC itself is quite conservative, but eventually will probably adopt these recommendations that many scientists are now advocating. First, if possible, go outdoors. Outdoors, you have ultraviolet light, which can destroy the virus. Also, you have wind patterns which can blow the virus away. And as they say, the solution to pollution is dilution. So you want to dilute the concentration of the virus by being outside. Now, of course, if you have a family member who does not necessarily wear masks or take precautions, put the pressure on them. At home, quarantine them if necessary. Punish them, whatever it takes, because people's lives are at stake now. And so, again, the home is the number one place where the virus is spread. And again, close contact with people, even breathing. Breathing can spread the virus. Of course, coughing and sneezing can do that, obviously. But simply breathing, singing, chanting, shouting can do it. If, for example, you're at a demonstration or a rally, first, make sure it's outdoors, not an indoor rally. Make sure that it's outdoors and stay away from the people who are loud, making noises, chanting, spraying the virus in all directions. And of course, it helps to be 6 feet away from other people, but that's a minimum. We now realize that the coronavirus can spread 20 feet easily. Here's a simple test called the garlic test. If you can smell the garlic on someone's breath, you are way too close to that individual. And again, the perfume test is simply to spray a room with perfume, which is in basically an aerosol form, and you realize how far, how far the virus can spread, much farther than the 6 feet that's recommended. And again, if possible, even for family members, close people close to you that are staying at your house, social distance and get them tested because they could be coronavirus positive. And if you do go outside, wear glasses. We now realize that your eyes are one of the principal ways in which the virus can enter your body through your tears. And so wear wraparound glasses, wear shielding, face shields, whatever it takes to protect your eyes. And remember, get tested. PCR test is the best. Polymerase chain reaction test is the best way. The rapid testing is not as reliable. There's some people who can test positive with one test and test negative on the other. So who do you believe? The PCR test. That's the test that I took. Now, the next question is, what's the latest concerning when you should call a doctor and go to the hospital? If you've been exposed to the virus, chances are on average 5 days. 5 days you will be showing symptoms. In 5 days you will be infectious, sometimes up to 2 weeks. But on average it peaks at around 5 days. And then people gut it out. They cough, they sneeze, there's a tightness of their chest, but it's livable with. You can live with it. That's the danger. Because by the time you can't breathe and you go to the hospital, it's almost too late. In fact, when they put you on a ventilator, it is almost too late. 90%, up to 90% of those people on ventilators never make it. They die because of organ failure, because of dropping oxygen levels in your blood. So what are you supposed to do? Measure the oxygen level in your blood in your home? Well, yeah. I would recommend that you buy an oximeter. Maybe you already have a thermometer in your house, but what's the danger signals? When should you call a doctor and have yourself submitted to the emergency room of a hospital? By the time you have difficulty breathing, it could be too late. So that's why many doctors now are recommending an oxygen meter, an oximeter. Very easy to get. They only cost about $50 on the internet. It's a small device about an inch across. You basically clip it on to your finger. It does not break the skin. There's no blood involved. It's nothing but a flashlight inside that tiny device that shoots infrared radiation. You see, when you have oxygen in your blood is red. When it's depleted of oxygen, it's purple. And so this little device simply shoots light across your fingertip and measures the color and the amount of absorption that takes place in your finger. Within about, three to five seconds, it tells you your oxygen level. Normally, it should be 98%+. When the oximeter starts to drop below that point, below 98%, that's when you should seriously think about calling a doctor. And the doctor, in turn, may ask you a simple question. What is your oxygen level reading? At that point, you can tell the doctor that it's falling below 98%, and chances are you'll wind up in an IC unit before you have organ failure, before you're like one step away from dying. And the next question, if you are on a ventilator, if you are one of the fractions of a percent of those individuals that are on death's door, what should you get? Well, it turns out there's one and only one chemical that seems to reduce the death rate among those people that are on death's door. And that is dexamethasone. It's a cheap steroid drug, only costs about $1 a day. And we now know that steroids tamp down the inflammation because you see, the virus doesn't kill you at all. The virus is, after all, just a molecule. How can a molecule kill something as big as a human being? Because this molecule sets off a chain reaction of your body's immune system, which overreacts. It floods your body with harmful antibodies, which can cause organ failure throughout other parts of your body. In some sense, your body is committing suicide. And so how to tamp down the immune system? A steroid called dexamethasone. And I should tell you that my next door neighbor was actually on death's door, very bad case of coronavirus. He was given dexamethasone, and within hours, he could sense that there was new life circulating inside his body. So again, a word to the wise, read up on the coronavirus and realize that there are things you can do when you are living in close quarters, perhaps with someone with the virus, precautions you can take, and worst comes to worst, take dexamethasone. Well, also in the news, global warming is back in the news. Many people wonder, is there a point of no return? A point beyond which it's hopeless? Well, actually, probably not. There's probably more than one point of no return. One of the first points of no return is Greenland. Greenland is a huge, gigantic ice mass. It's a source of much of the sea level rise on the planet Earth, and it's thawing out. Large areas of Greenland are thawing, but let's be fair, ice is also being replenished every year as well. So there's a steady state. In fact, up to the year 2000, scientists were able to verify that every year about 450 billion tons of ice melted, only to be replenished the following winter. So there was a steady state. Every year you lose 450 billion tons of ice, and every year you get it back, until now. It turns out the scientists analyzing the flows of ice found that after the year 2000, this equilibrium started to get disrupted, with more ice melting and disintegrating than returning. In other words, we're passing the point of no return. Even if we were to rein in all our greenhouse gases right now, this would continue to march on for generations. And that's sobering. Even if we were to take all these precautions and magically get rid of all this carbon dioxide, we would still see the melting of Greenland. Now, what does that mean? I mean, after all, Greenland is way up there. I mean, why should I care about that? Well, you see, there are problems. First of all, if Greenland were to melt, it would raise the sea level around the planet Earth. Greenland is also way up there in the northern hemisphere, meaning that the weather currents, the jet stream, could be altered by the melting of Greenland, and that in turn affects the winter cycle and your weather. Third, and most ominous, off the coast of Greenland, there is the Gulf Stream. You know, the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico, believe it or not, form a river, an underwater river that goes from the Americas over to northern Europe. In fact, one of the first people to document this river inside the ocean was Benjamin Franklin. On one of his numerous trips across the Atlantic, he realized that there was this underwater river of warm water that connected the Americas to northern Europe. Now, take a map of northern Europe out and listen to a geography lesson. Take a look at England and trace England back toward the United States. You may say to yourself that England should be parallel to New York or Washington, D.C. The temperature of England is moderate, so perhaps it's parallel to New York. Well, you'd be surprised to find out that no. The United Kingdom is not parallel to New York. It's parallel to northern Canada. In other words, Europe should be frozen over. But why isn't Europe frozen over? It's because of warm waters from the Gulf of Mexico. And if, hypothetically, you have billions of tons of fresh water entering the Atlantic, disrupting the Gulf Stream, you can then freeze Europe over. Europe would have a mini ice age because it's no longer warmed up by the ocean currents coming from the Gulf of Mexico. Now that, of course, is a worst case scenario, but ironically enough, it could create a mini ice age, an ice age in northern Europe, because of the melting of fresh water that disrupts the Gulf Stream from the Gulf of Mexico. In other words, all hell's going to break loose with the weather if Greenland begins to melt. And also, let's say a few things about outer space. It turns out that scientists have now been able to take a photograph of the event horizon of a black hole that made big news several months ago. But here's a small little footnote to that. Scientists recently, quite by accident, found the closest black hole to the planet Earth. It's not millions of light years from the planet Earth, like other black holes we see lurking in the center of other galaxies, like M87. In fact, even our own black hole at the center of our own galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, there at the center lies a black hole that is roughly 50,000 light years away. Well, here's a new record. Scientists have just discovered the closest black hole to the sun, and it's only 1,000 light years away. That's a hop, skip, and a jump. That is so close to the planet Earth, and yet there it is, and it's almost visible with the naked eye. I say that because it's part of a triple star system. Scientists first noticed two stars. They were going around each other, as they should when they're close to each other gravitationally, but their orbits were slightly distorted, meaning that there was a third body there. And they were shocked when they calculated the weight of this third body causing the first two stars to be distorted. They found out that it weighed about 4 million times the mass of our sun. In other words, it was a black hole. A triple star system, one system being a black hole. And it's in a new constellation called Telescopium. You can Google that. And with the naked eye, you can see the double star system in Telescopium. And you have to use your imagination a little bit to realize that it's part of a triple star system. And that triple star system, one of which contains a black hole. Now, then the next question is, if it's that close to us, is it dangerous? Well, no. You see, if you fall into a black hole, you don't come out. That's why it's called a black hole. However, it turns out that we are not thrust into a black hole because we orbit. We orbit around the black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and therefore we are not entering a black hole and being crushed to death. And the next question is, where is this monster black hole that is at the center of our galaxy? Well, you can see it tonight. It's in the constellation Sagittarius. Now, if you look in the direction of the black hole, it's kind of disappointing. Dust clouds cover it over. But use your imagination. If you were to somehow remove the dust clouds in the center of the Milky Way galaxy, you would see the galactic nuclei, this fireball that almost outshines the moon. Think about that. Every night, this gigantic fireball would descend into outer space containing billions of stars. And at the very center of that fireball, there is a raging black hole, 2 to 4 million times more massive than the sun. Well, this new black hole is not so sensational. It's a small black hole, just 1,000 light years away. But as I said, the star system that contains the black hole is visible with the naked eye. And speaking about outer space, meteors are once again in the news. Meteors come whizzing by the planet Earth all the time, we now realize. We didn't know this before, but now we have satellites, telescopes that can track these things, and we're shocked. We're shocked to realize how much junk there is out there that comes very close to the planet Earth. Well, there's a new meteor or asteroid that has set records because it is the closest one ever detected by astronomers. Well, the asteroid is called 2020 QG, and it eluded us because it came from the backside of the sun. You see, if an object orbits around the sun, travels around the backside of the sun, and then comes whizzing out the other end, we, at the other end, are shocked to find this object coming out from the backside of the sun that we cannot see because of the sunlight. Well, it turns out that this meteor, about the size of a car, came from behind the sun, caught us off guard, and we realized that, hey, this is the closest asteroid ever clocked, traveling right under our nose. And you realize that it was only 1,000 miles away at its closest approach. Now, let's put that into perspective. The distance from the Earth to the Moon is about 250,000 miles. This object skimmed the Earth 1,000 miles away. So in other words, you're talking about an object 0.5% the distance from the Earth to the Moon, basically hugging the Earth way inside the orbit of the Earth to the Moon. And the next question is, well, how dangerous was that object? I mean, it was not the size of an apartment building. That would cause a lot of concern. It was the size of a car. Well, we don't know for sure. We think that it might have broken up in the upper atmosphere, and we would have seen several smaller streaks of light caused by a meteor. A lot of the meteors you see at night, for example, are caused by objects as small as a marble. This is as big as a car, and some of it may have actually reached the planet Earth. However, I should point out that we are tracking another chunk of rock that is potentially dangerous. It is the asteroid Apophis. It is about 1,000 feet across. It's bigger than the Rose Bowl Stadium. It's about 1,000 feet across, and it's going to whiz by the planet Earth in the year 2029. In fact, it's going to whiz by the planet Earth so close, you'll see it streak across the atmosphere with your binoculars. That's right, you won't need a fancy telescope to see Apophis. You'll simply look up in the sky and see an object whizzing over your head that is basically skimming our atmosphere. And the next question is, on the second pass in the year 2036, it might actually hit the Earth. Now, we're not sure about this. We know that on the first pass, 2029, Apophis will miss the planet Earth. We're tracking it very carefully because, of course, the fate of the Earth depends upon it. And we think that it'll miss. However, depending upon how close it comes through the atmosphere, we don't know how it's going to interact with the atmosphere. So on the second pass, there are some computer programs which show that it might, just might, hit the planet Earth. That would be really dangerous because that thing is 1,000 feet across. I mean, it's a city buster. It could easily knock out New York City, Moscow, or London, easily. And so it's something that we have to prepare for and worry about. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. In the second part of Exploration, we're going to continue our discussion of the social responsibility of scientists. We're going to talk about Heinz Harber, one of the greatest chemists of all time, and a man who unfortunately worked for the Nazis and helped to create the poison gas, which was eventually used to gas his own relatives. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration. Welcome back to Exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. In the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about the social responsibility of scientists. What happens when some of the greatest scientists of all time, like Heinz Harber, winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, one of the fathers of modern chemistry, uses his formidable chemical skills to create poison gas for the Nazis, which are then used to gas his own relatives. A tragedy. Here's a man who figured out how to fix nitrogen in the air into fertilizer, making the Green Revolution possible, creating the population we see today on the planet Earth. But the tragedy of his life is he also worked for the Nazis. So, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Daniel Charles, biographer of Heinz Haber, one of the greatest chemists of modern times, who unfortunately created poison gas warfare.
And in the second part of Exploration, we're going to bring on Daniel Charles, author of the book Mastermind, The Rise and Fall of Fritz Haber, the Nobel laureate who launched the age of chemical warfare. So here is a man who changed the face of modern chemistry. For example, the Green Revolution, which greatly expanded the population of the Earth, is due to the work of Fritz Haber. He showed that nitrogen in the air can be fixed and put into fertilizer. Believe it or not, the modern Green Revolution would be impossible without the work of Fritz Haber. However, he also worked for the Nazis, designing poison gas for the Nazis, which ironically were used to gas his own relatives. And so in this half of Exploration, we're going to be talking about Fritz Haber, the Nobel laureate who launched the age of chemical warfare, but also helped to create the Green Revolution, which greatly expanded the population of humanity. Okay, let's talk about his childhood. Every scientist, of course, goes through a process, usually as a youth, where they get fascinated by the laws of physics, chemistry, and stars. What was it about his youth that propelled him in that direction?
Well, there are stories of him concocting chemical experiments, you know, in his boyhood, getting actually thrown out of the house for doing it, but then a friendly aunt gave him room, apparently, in her house to conduct these chemical experiments. Mm-hmm. So there was a personal interest, but also Fritz Haber was so much, almost eerily, a product of his times. And science in general, and chemistry in particular, was the field within which Germany was excelling at the time when he was growing up, the latter part of the 1800s. It was something that Germany, it was an industry that Germany dominated. And Haber, I think, partly because he had this sense of wanting to escape his town. He wanted to be important. He wanted to rise in society. He wanted to be successful. I think partly he latched onto the thing that seemed to be the path toward success.
And so he was very ambitious as a youth, right? But he grew up in a Jewish family. So could you explain how his religious identity changed over the years?
He did grow up Jewish. He grew up in a large Jewish clan in the city of Breslau. It's now Wrocław in Poland. He was part of that generation of German Jews who, for the first time, really could participate almost fully in German society. The legal restrictions had, to a large extent, been dropped. Professions were open to them that had never been open to their ancestors. And Fritz Haber just seized on these opportunities with all his might. In his 20s, he converted to Christianity. And this was, to some extent, a rejection of his past, a rejection of his father, with whom he had many conflicts. But it was also a identification with this increasingly powerful German state. He wanted to be, he said, much later in life, in trying to explain his decision to convert, he took it as a step toward being more fully German.
And what about comparing him a little bit to Einstein? Einstein also came out of that same social milieu. Jews, as you mentioned, were beginning to be more accepted in German society. Science was the big thing, the meal ticket for a lot of young, ambitious Jewish youth. Einstein was part of that whole movement, but then Einstein began to reject a lot of things associated with the Prussian tradition. But I guess Haber went the other way, right?
Right. Einstein and Haber are interesting kind of counterexamples to each other. They were both German Jews, as you mentioned, but Haber rejected that Jewish identity in favor of the German identity. Einstein never liked Germany much. For whatever reason, Einstein just couldn't abide nationalisms of any sort, and particularly German nationalism. He actually renounced his German citizenship as a young man. So while Haber was renouncing his Jewish identity, Einstein was rejecting his German identity. He was never very religious, Einstein wasn't, but he always felt almost compelled to stand, you know, with what he called his tribe, and that included identifying with and supporting the Zionist movement and the establishment of the Jewish homeland in Israel.
And in fact, Einstein renounced his citizenship as a teenager, which is something very rare for most teenagers to become stateless.
Yeah, unheard of, particularly at that place and that time. And the authorities didn't know what to do with him, basically.
Right. Well, Einstein, of course, had a very checkered early career. He couldn't get a job. He worked in a patent office. We all hear about these stories of his early days. However, Haber was like a meteor in some sense. Could you now trace a little bit his scientific rise?
He also struggled for a few years after university. He was kind of an outsider. He didn't kind of get on the fast track immediately. But once he did, at the university in Karlsruhe, he just worked tirelessly. He made himself an expert on new fields, it seemed like, every year. And by happenstance, he got his hands on a particular scientific problem that had been the subject of much talk, this idea of how to capture nitrogen from the air and convert it into a chemical form that would be useful for fertilizer, the so-called nitrogen fixing problem. And that's how he made his great fame and his fortune.
Now, could you elaborate on that? You know, the average person, if you were to mention nitrogen fixing, their eyes sort of glaze over.
Exactly.
But this is absolutely essential for the prosperity of the human race. We have, 6.5 billion people on the planet Earth right now. We wouldn't have 6.5 billion people on the planet Earth in some sense without the work of Fritz Haber. So explain to us how absolutely essential it is for our dinner table.
Right. Well, okay, so here's an interesting fact. All protein contains nitrogen atoms. All DNA contains nitrogen atoms. Today, you know, you look at your dinner plate, you look at your own flesh, and roughly, let's say, half of the nitrogen atoms that are in that food, that are in your body, came from a factory. They came from an ammonia factory, using the process, the chemical process that Haber invented. Basically, nitrogen is the fuel that drives intensive agriculture. Wherever fields year after year produce plentiful harvests, farmers are pumping nitrogen into the soil and plants are bringing it back out. And a lot of that nitrogen ends up wasted, sort of flowing down streams and becoming pollution. But around the turn of the century, around 1900, scientists began to glimpse the fact that the world had a limited supply of nitrogen for agriculture, and they wondered what would happen when the nitrate mines in Chile, which is what Europe was relying on for fertilizer, when they ran out. And so they said, there's incredible amounts of nitrogen in the air in this form of what they call N2, these tightly bound double atoms of nitrogen. How can we convince those nitrogen atoms to break apart and link up, say, to hydrogen instead, forming NH3, ammonia, which then plants could use, because plants cannot use the nitrogen in the air for food. That was the essential problem, how to capture nitrogen, this limitless supply of nitrogen from the air, convert it into a form that could fuel world food production.
Now, as I understand, some bacteria can actually take nitrogen from the air and make it into fertilizer, but that's very limited process. And so we had this bottleneck. The human population could not grow beyond what we can feed them. And therefore, there was this bottleneck with fertilizer that Haber solved by then taking nitrogen from the air, limitless nitrogen from the air, and making fertilizer out of it. This is staggering if you think about it, right? I mean, look around. The people you see, your friends, your neighbors, they wouldn't be here. In some sense, they wouldn't be here without Fritz Haber, right?
That's right. Well, a lot of things would be different. Yeah, I mean, particularly in China or India or Indonesia, parts of the world that are very heavily populated, that's where humanity would have run into the limits first. North America, we would just eat less meat. We could do it without the added nitrogen. But you know, the world would be different without that nitrogen fixing, that nitrogen capturing process. The world probably wouldn't have run into those limits until, say, the 60s. They were glimpsed in Haber's time, but they weren't really, you know, coming into play until 50 years after his life.
Now, we always hear the stories of struggling artists and poverty-stricken intellectuals, but here was a man who had some financial savvy as well, and he became wealthy. Could you elaborate?
Well, Fritz Haber struck a deal with this industrial partner of his, the BASF company, which actually still exists. He said, you know, so we have this patent on this nitrogen fixing process, this ammonia synthesis. For every unit of ammonia that you make, I, Fritz Haber, the inventor of this, will get a penny or two. And that wouldn't have been so significant had not World War I came along. But at that point, the German military was cut off from its supply of nitrogen for explosives. And suddenly, Haber's nitrogen-fixing process becomes the key to keeping Germany in the war. And they built enormous factories and produced unbelievable quantities of ammonia. And Fritz Haber was getting money out of every kilogram of ammonia they produced. He became fabulously wealthy, worth a millionaire many times over.
So, in other words, on one hand, he creates a nitrogen process which, in some sense, changed the course of agriculture. And then that same chemical genius goes to make weapons of war and made him wealthy, right?
It turns out, yeah, it turns out that the first really large-scale use of the nitrogen process was for warfare.
And what about his Nobel Prize?
It's an interesting story there. Immediately after the First World War, when Haber has really become infamous in parts of the world, the Swedish Academy of Sciences awards him the Nobel Prize for this ammonia synthesis. There were great protests in France and snide articles in the New York Times about it. But Fritz Haber took it as a vindication for German science.
Okay, now let's talk about Fritz Haber, the man, his political views, his social views. Here was a man who became wealthy, in some sense, on weapons of war. However, he also opened up a whole new area of agriculture, which is continuing to impact the human race even today. What was in his mind? What was his thinking process? What made him tick?
I think, first, there was ambition. Fritz Haber was a driven man. He really wanted to be important, to be successful, to make a contribution, to be well known, to rise in society. He was somehow compelled to do that. And you can look for psychological explanations in his escaping his Jewish identity as a young man. He also was a creature of his times. He believed in technical progress. He believed in technology. And he believed also in his duty to the state. He was a patriot, not in the sense that he, as some Germans were, convinced that Germany was somehow superior culturally to other countries. Fritz Haber wasn't that kind of patriot, but he totally believed in his duty to Germany. The state's goals became his own, and when the country went to war, Fritz Haber jumped to the front lines.
And what about his fate between wars? Many people, of course, lost fortunes. Germany was humiliated. Reparations bled the economy. And in some sense, people think the seas of Nazism rose between World War I and World War II. What happened to his fortunes?
Well, Fritz Haber remained a prominent member of German society after the First World War. He led his institute in Berlin. He did lose a big chunk of his personal fortune, but he retained some as well. So he really, for much of this time, was pretty well off. But he again was tied to his country, and he was distressed by Germany's misfortunes. He saw the rising tide of anti-Semitism, and his health also declined in this era. It was a difficult time for Fritz Haber. He tried many things and had sort of the growing sense that maybe things were not working out all for the best.
Okay, and how did he view the gradual rise of Nazism? He died in 1934. However, 1933 is when Hitler rose to the chancellorship of Germany. So what happened now in the late 20s and especially the early 30s where you could see the rise of Nazism?
Well, Haber was dead set against the Nazis, partly because he was Jewish, and the Nazis were, he knew, his enemies. But beyond that, I mean, Haber was kind of on the right side during the 1920s. He was a Democrat. He participated in elections in a political party that was generally sort of middle of the road, pro-elections. He had friends among the socialists on the left as well. So he was distressed by the rise of the Nazis, and when they took power in 1933, he saw, in a sense, the writing on the wall. He realized very quickly that by their definition, he was Jewish. He was not Christian. And when they passed a law saying no Jews can be part of the civil service, Haber was in the position of having to dismiss many members of his own institute. He himself didn't have to resign immediately because he was a World War I veteran, and there was an exemption for that. But he did the honorable thing. He tried to protect the most vulnerable in his institute, found positions for them outside the country. Very quickly, though, he'd had enough, and he resigned in protest in the spring of 1933. Spent the rest of that year wandering around Europe trying to find a new place for him to live, for himself to live.
And what about his friends and associates? You mentioned in your book that his associate that helped to also produce that same nitrogen process tried to help him, but there are limits to what you can do, especially with the rise of Nazism dominating the entire German political scene. But were there any attempts to help him before he went into exile?
Well, sure. Both Max Planck, the great physicist, and Karl Bosch, the industrialist, head of the biggest chemical company in Germany, they both went actually to Hitler and said, you're hurting Germany by forcing these talented German scientists into exile. And in both cases, Hitler, basically wanted nothing to do with this. According to one account, he said to Max Planck, I'm finished with the Jew Haber.
And I've read some accounts of that famous meeting between Max Planck, the great founder of the quantum theory, and Adolf Hitler. And Adolf Hitler at one point storms off into a tangent and screams and yells and says, I am not weak. I am not weak. People say that I am weak, but I am strong. And after that meeting, Planck said, quote, you cannot reason with men like that.
Yeah, yeah. I understand that Max Planck decided he had to just leave. He just had to leave the meeting. There was nothing to be said.
Now, the tragedy is what became of his work, especially on poisons, after he died. How did the Nazis exploit that technology that Fritz Haber unleashed on the world, especially chemical warfare?
Well, we haven't talked too much about his work on chemical weapons. Haber really pioneered the use of poison gas on the battlefield. He drove that forward. He recruited troops. He was at the front lines. He orchestrated the first attack with poison gas in April of 1915. He also was very interested in the use of poison gas for the control of insects. He developed techniques for eradicating insects from granaries, from ships, from barracks where troops were staying. And in his institute, they developed a particular insecticide for that purpose, and they called it Zyklon. Immediately after the war, they improved the formulation some and called it Zyklon B. And in the 1920s, that insecticide was sold across Europe for the control of insects. And after the Second World War started, long after Haber had died, the SS acquired large quantities of that insecticide. They asked the manufacturers of it to reformulate it somewhat, and they used that poison gas, the product of Haber's Institute, in the death camps to gas millions of human beings. And among those were some of Haber's distant relatives.
And let's talk about that. In some sense, what goes around comes around. He unleashes chemical warfare on the battlefield, and then it goes all the way around, and then it's used to gas some of his relatives. Do you see some irony there?
It's almost macabre. This is one of the things about his story that makes it almost irresistible for a dramatist. People do things all the time, and their accomplishments have unintended consequences, but usually for other people.
Mm-hmm.
It usually doesn't come back around to yourself. But in Haber's case, he was an instrument of German nationalism in the First World War. He fed the beast that ultimately turned on him and chased him out of Germany. He invented poison gas that was used to kill people to whom he was intimately connected. It's a strange, bizarre, and thought-provoking story.
Okay, and also I understand his wife committed suicide, perhaps in the realization that her husband unleashed this monster on the world. But what are your thoughts?
Well, Clara Immervar was her name, Haber's first wife. She was a chemist herself, very unusual. She was the first woman to receive a doctorate in chemistry from the university in Breslau, where she grew up. She'd been unhappy for years in the marriage, but in 1915, a week after the first gas attack, which Haber had organized, Haber came home on leave, and in those few days when he was home, in the middle of the night, Clara Immervar picked up his army-issued pistol, went down to the garden, and killed herself with it. She didn't leave a note, as far as we know. Other people afterward talked about how she was opposed to her husband's work in war. We can't know exactly what was going on in that marriage, but for many people, and I think it's a reasonable thought, her suicide stands as a kind of condemnation of Fritz Haber's activities during World War I.
Okay, now let's talk about the larger question of science, scientists, war, and social responsibility. On one hand, some people say that perhaps we're too harsh on Fritz Haber, because after all, he died before he realized that his work would be used to gas millions of Jews and communists and Russians and gypsies. But on the other hand, some people would say that he should have been hung as a war criminal because he willingly unleashed this whole era of chemical warfare on the battlefield. So there's a spectrum. Some people say, hang him. Other people say, well, look at the social context that they were essentially puppets of governments who funded them. What are your thoughts?
Well, I have a number of thoughts. And, it's interesting to examine the reactions of contemporaries. There was a kind of brotherhood of gas warfare that emerged after World War I. Some of the leading British figures, scientists in the British chemical war effort after World War I, became friends of Haber's, and they actually gave him comfort and a place to land when he got chased out of Germany in 1933. I sort of in the reason I wrote the book the way I did, and I think some would probably call it too sympathetic to Fritz Haber, is I think the spirit of Fritz Haber is still very much alive and generally accepted in our society. Fritz Haber was ambitious, so are many. Fritz Haber was a technocrat, so are many today. Fritz Haber wanted to solve problems. He wanted to help his country. He put his skills and gifts at the service of his nation in peacetime and in wartime, and I think that's what maybe most scientists do today. Now, you can argue, say, oh, well, chemical weapons was a horrible thing. Chemical warfare was simply, as Haber saw it, the cutting edge. It was the new technological frontier. 20 years later, that technological frontier, well, 30 years later, the technological frontier was in the area of physics, not chemistry, and we saw the atom bomb. You know, another 50 years, and the technological frontier today is probably, computer scientists and electrical engineering. But I think the spirit of what Fritz Haber did is not all that different from what we can witness today.
Well, let's say a few things about Fritz Haber's contemporary, Werner Heisenberg. He, of course, is one of the founders of quantum mechanics. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle is named after him. The play Copenhagen won the best play in London and New York concerning whether or not Heisenberg deliberately sabotaged Nazi effort to build the atomic bomb or whether he was an accomplice to Adolf Hitler's reach for nuclear energy. The play was rather sympathetic and simply said maybe he was just a nationalist and left open the possibility that he sabotaged Hitler's reach for the atomic bomb. But recently, a letter was released by the family of Niels Bohr, who was Heisenberg's mentor. And in that letter, never mailed from Niels Bohr to his student, Heisenberg, it mentions the fact that you, the student, Heisenberg, wanted to recruit me, Niels Bohr, one of the founders of atomic physics, to work on the Nazi atomic bomb because the Nazi victory was inevitable. And since the Nazis were going to triumph anyway, why not join the winning side? So here we have a supreme irony. Quantum mechanics, the theory that Heisenberg pioneered, is used every day in modern electronics, computers, lasers, the internet, satellite communications. Modern society would collapse today without quantum mechanics. We use it in the transistor. We use it in the computers. However, let's be honest about this. Werner Heisenberg also worked on the German atomic bomb.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration. And if you want to know more about what I do, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers, so find out what I'm up to. Again, that's mkaku.org. Good day.